If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and my guest this week is the psychoanalyst and writer Josh Cohen, whose new book is called All the Rage, Why Anger Drives the World. Now, Josh, this is a book with huge sweep, and it pushes into some of the angriest corners of modern life. But you start with nextdoor.com. Is that a sort of uncharity begins at home thing?
Yes, it might be. I was trying to think about the first place to start when thinking about anger. And in a way, it's in the body. I want to convey a sense of what it feels like to be angry. And the sort of immediate, ordinary to hand experience was going through this email dump that I seem to get every morning from various next door correspondents. I was interested in the particular conditions, if you like, under which people participate in Nextdoor, because nextdoor.com is a resource for neighborhoods, which means that only those in your neighborhood are posting on it, which means that there isn't really the space for that kind of megaphonic, declamatory, grandiose rhetoric that you get on other social media platforms. And so people speak with a much more sort of gritty, bodily irritation. The grain of the speech is entirely different. And instead of speaking from the Olympian height of judgment and condemnation, people really just talk about how pissed off they are about this or that experience in the neighborhood. So I was interested in contrasting these, you know, one very visceral and bodily expression of anger and one rather sort of abstract and performative, and sort of beginning from the former, beginning from the sense of just what it's like to be the recipient and to be experiencing one's own anger.
When we talk about anger, I mean, you have a very sophisticated kind of psychoanalytic understanding of it. And I'm interested in some of the distinctions you draw, for instance, when you're setting out your stool. Is that you differentiate anger, for instance, from aggression. And indeed, you suggest that anger can come after aggression rather than vice versa, which maybe is what one would kind of ordinarily expect. Can you explain a bit how you make that distinction and what its use is?
Yes. The distinction, in a way, comes from a certain kind of theoretical framework in psychoanalysis around the idea of the drive, which even within psychoanalysis is often considered a sort of old-fashioned, sort of very classical Freudian notion. But I think it's one that has all kinds of resources for thinking about life in general, but this particular phenomenon. The drive is interesting in that we think of psychoanalysis rightly as being preoccupied with the interior life exclusively. And yet the thing about the drive is it's really about the passage from the inside to the outside. What is it when we feel something that we want to send out into the world? What is our aim? What is our objective? And the drive is really about that. You know, Freud's first definition or first definitional steps around the drive are that it has an aim and it has an object. In other words, we want to do something with it. That's the aim. And we want to address it to somebody. You know, we aim, for example, to love someone and have a child with them. And we do it with this particular object. In aggression, then, we have a particular aim. We want somebody to know how furious we are by yelling at them or hitting them. And of course, our aggression has an object in the world. Now, anger may have an object, but it doesn't really have an aim. It's a feeling. It's something that lodges inside us that can or cannot be discharged in the form of an action or even in the form of words. So anger is an interior state that we carry around with us that we may choose to make visible and audible in the world, but which may also lodge in us in a way that isn't evident to the people around us. And that, and this is quite important, I suppose, may not even be evident to ourselves. I think one of the most interesting clinical phenomena in psychoanalysis is how often people say, until I really talked it through, I didn't realize how X I felt. And the most common of those really is how angry I felt.
You've touched on it just now, but I was very intrigued. You seem to suggest that anger and aggression, kind of parceled up as they are in some ways a sort of allied or shadow selves of, you know, what in layman's terms we call love or desire, that the sort of libidinous drives are kind of analogous in some way to anger, that they've got something in common that other emotional states and drives don't have.
Yes, that's right. And what they have in common, really, and this is, I think, the kernel of the drive, which I think is still very modern, very contemporary, and very relevant to thinking about our own predicament, and that opens up into much kind of worldlier regions than just personal life, political life in particular. The drive is about satisfaction, but it's also very much about dissatisfaction. Because in psychoanalysis, the point about the drive is that it never sort of tidily consummates itself. It never sort of finds its aim in a way that satisfies the person sort of possessed by the drive. So the drive is intrinsically an experience of attempted satisfaction and actual dissatisfaction. Freud says that there is something in the nature of the sexual drive that doesn't allow of complete satisfaction. In other words, whatever itch you're trying to scratch, there is always going to be a residue of the itch. And my feeling is that that model, which really begins with the idea of love and sexuality, is entirely applicable to anger and aggression. That there is always a kind of residue of our attempts to discharge our aggression in the external world. And that residue, in fact, is generally what we call anger. Anger is what we feel when we haven't been able to do something with it.
Yes, you talk about failed rage as one of the four rage states. And maybe we'll get on to that. But as you've again touched on, this is a book that talks about anger at the personal level, and you describe many case studies from your own psychoanalytic work, but also the international level. How closely do these things connect? Can you talk about, you know, which you do, the age of rage in a way that maps analogously onto to the personal and individual drives and aggressions?
I think so. It's always been a kind of conundrum within psychology as well as psychoanalysis, as to how to link the individual experience, because the individual mind is in a way the inevitable model for psychology, and yet we do want to understand the psychology of much larger units. Now, Freud tended to link the two on the basis of a kind of analogy, so that the group works as though it were an individual mind. I'm not sure that that's the most satisfactory way to see it. I tend to think that, in a way, it's more psychoanalytic to think of the individual not as a discrete unit, sort of hived off from other discrete units. In a way, this is the kind of classical liberal conception of the individual. But if we think of the individual as immediately enmeshed from the moment that they're born into a network of social and emotional relationships, that as soon as there's one, if you like, there are two. So that when a person is in psychotherapy or psychoanalysis, you're analyzing their mind, but their mind is also a crucible of so many other relationships and influences and forces, some of which are in the immediate present, some of which are in the personal past, and some of which are in the deep past. So that a family, for example, that is conditioned by different kinds of historical trauma, that is transmitted to the family context and then to the individual context. So that there's a kind of a commutation between the individual and the group that I don't think one really has to contrive, because you're always looking at a force field of phenomena that are sort of competing for influence, and that this is something that happens at every level of experience from the individual to the group.
But we seem to know, don't we, that, you know, people talk about crowd psychology as being very different from individual psychology, in the sense that there's all sorts of sort of disinhibition that goes on in very large groups of people, and that crowds do behave with their own mind. Was it that started you on this book? I'm wondering, I mean, you use that phrase, age of rage. Do you think we are living in a uniquely ragey age? And if so, why? And was that the germ of the book for you?
Yeah, it was the germ of the book. More or less any book that I write starts from a kind of itch, a sense that something in the world around me is circulating in a way that's poking at some vulnerable spot in me. And in this case, it was the feeling that sort of everywhere one turned in the culture, and perhaps closer to home as well, you saw a kind of frighteningly easy passage from provocation to anger to aggression. And so usually writing a book for me will be an exercise in making sense of something which is troubling me in that way. And yes, I do think so. Now, I'm not sure that we're necessarily under more provocation than we ever were. I'm not sure that we have accumulated any more copious reasons to be angry than were always there in any age. I think actually, and I'm almost sorry to turn to it because it does seem to be the kind of the explanatory principle we rely on so much these days, but I do think that the internet and social media has proliferated not just the provocations of rage, but the circulation, the contagion of rage. I think that being aware of communities of people giving vent to their feelings of anger and fury licenses us to be in immediate contact with our anger and to find ways to discharge it in a way that I think is unprecedented. And I think that in a way, it also encourages us to externalize anger. Now, some people might say, well, that's a good thing. It's a good thing to give expression to your state of mind, not to bottle it up. It's a form of protest. It's a form of authenticity. There are all kinds of ways that you can justify this kind of ready expression. Where I try to get to in the book is to say that actually, when aggression is so readily accessible, or when anger discharges itself so easily in aggressive words or actions, what you have is not something more emotionally authentic. Because when you act on your anger too quickly, even if it's just by writing some particularly vituperative below-the-line comment or something, or a tweet, a rage tweet or whatever we're supposed to call them, when that happens, we are not actually in contact with our anger so much as trying to get rid of it. We're trying to find an immediate outlet that allows us to be rid of the burden of rage that we would otherwise have to carry. So that kind of hydraulic venting rage, I think, does not speak to a state of sort of public psychic health at all. I think it speaks to a condition of massive enervation, that people are feeling more and trying to find ways to discharge more. But in fact, the more they do that, the more enervated and anxious and nervous they feel.
Well, to step out of the frame of purely psychoanalytic readings, I mean, economics enters this, doesn't it? What does it tell us that this is where the money is? That the expression of these strong feelings has become, you know, a colossally important monetizable resource?
Yes. I talk more in a way in explicitly political and economic terms about the cynical exploitation of anger. But it absolutely does belong to an economic context as well. And I think in this particular sense, that you can generate anger in order to craft it, in order to give it a channel, what you might call in psychoanalytic terms a form of sublimation. In other words, somewhere created in which to channel feelings of anger. I think what social media platforms, as well as populist political movements, are doing is not so much identifying an anger that needs to be addressed and remedied on the basis of a concrete program of policy and social transformation, economic transformation. Instead, it's using anger as a kind of gift that keeps on giving, as a kind of bottomless political and economic resource. As long as people stay angry, they're still donating to these political movements. They're still subscribing to these platforms. They're feeding the beast of a particular kind of social interaction. And I think the point about anger is that it is so self-perpetuating that it does feed off itself so effectively.
It's a bit of logic of late capitalism aspect to that, that you know, you've found something that creates a limitless resource and a limitless appetite. You know, we're manufacturing demand, obviously being the dream of, you know, the postmodern capitalist condition.
Yes, I think so. And I think that in a way, it's not a surprise that the sort of the godfather of right populism, and in fact, so many of the leading figures around Trump do come out of the business context, and particularly a sort of platform capitalism context, whose point is really that there is no ceiling and no limit on the growth of demand, on the stimulation of demand. If people are angry, you can always make them angrier. The thing that they always have to avoid is finding an outlet that, if you like, would actually satisfy the anger. You know, whether that be a program of social transformation or more like a violent conflagration.
Well, I was interested in, you were quite sort of self-deprecating about this. You sort of said, described yourself watching what happened on the January riots, the storming of the Capitol, and you remembered saying words to the effect to yourself of, yeah, right, Trump sunk because he's now, unfortunately, allowed this to have its outlet. And so the resource is going to be dissipated or whatever. You know, he hasn't got this pool of limitless anger to pull on. And then, you know, half a chapter later, you go, actually, I got that one wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I'll make a confession about this, which I don't make in the book, but, you know, exclusive, heard it here first, Spectator podcast.
Scoop.
Which is that when I wrote that initial analysis, I didn't know I'd got it wrong. Neither did anybody else, to be fair. Trump really was in a perilous position. DeSantis seemed to be in the ascendancy and no one was visiting him at Mar-a-Lago. His star really did seem to have fallen at the time I was writing it. And I really thought that January had done for him. So it was quite interesting over the coming months revisiting that chapter, which was the one I wrote first, and saying, oh my God, well, I look a bit foolish here. So I thought, without being too confessional and meta about it, I would work that in to the analysis. And it turned out that I was wrong, precisely because Trump recognized or just fed off rage as the endlessly renewable resource. And he did that with a kind of boldness, because he moved from a position of performative contrition and kind of shamefaced hiding or trying to forget it, to a very sort of vocal and aggressive defense of the January riots, which is now fueling, well, a possible victory in a couple of weeks.
To take us back a little bit, you know, we've got these great avatars of rage in the modern era, but can you talk a little bit about how myth and the sort of religious texts and mythological texts that go way back, I mean, Bronze Age and before, have figured rage and understood anger? And are they ways that still make sense to us now? Because you've got a very interesting chapter that touches on that.
Yeah, I think they do still speak to us. I think they speak to us in a particular way. I mean, I suppose the ultimate avatar of rage, of course, would have to be the God of the Hebrew Bible, whom I talk about quite a lot in the first part of the book. And you could even say, actually, in the first part of the Hebrew Bible, the God of Genesis in particular, is one whose acts do perfectly consummate his rage. So that, I mean, God may be the only figure, if you like, for whom anger and aggression really do form a holistic whole. But when God says he's angry, the act that accompanies it is entirely adequate and equal to what, if you like, he is feeling. And so the various prophets have then to enter into a kind of negotiation with this perfectly consummating rage of God. Now, even as the Hebrew Bible goes a way down the timeline, so when we get to the book of Jonah, you have a rather interestingly different God who is quite touchingly contrite about his annihilatory ambitions. You know, he tells Jonah to go and proclaim to the people of Nineveh that they're finished, that he's going to wipe them all out. But when at the minute that they start repenting, God repents of his scheme and says, you know what, I'm just going to leave them alone because it isn't fair. They, you know, they have no idea what they're doing in any case. And what's that going to do to the cattle if all the people are gone?
Is this the Almighty on a good day, or is this him, as it were, maturing through the course of the Bible, if that's not a blasphemous thing to say about God?
If it's not a blasphemous thing to say, I think that it is God taking on certain kinds of human characteristics as he, if you like, weaves into the life of a people, sort of taking on the kind of hesitancies and doubts that were not there at the beginning of time with the first stories. So you never quite get that same absolute adequation of anger to action that you get perhaps in those first stories and in other theogonies and theologies and mythic frameworks, whether we're talking about, you know, Hindu or Greek, there's usually a figure at the beginning where you do get that sort of perfect adequation. And then a gap sort of forms. And that gap, in a way, I think, is sort of the intrusion of the human, because in the human, there's always that gap. Now, the thing is, the fantasy is always there for us of recovering, of somehow being able to act in such a way that our anger would be fully consummated, would find a kind of bear a perfect fruit in our action.
Well, Blake, as I told my wrath was spent.
Yeah, that's right. But more commonly, the experience that literature gives up is one in which the wrath is not spent, that there's sort of a feeling that whatever we've tried to do to get rid of it hasn't worked. I mean, one of many examples I could have given in the book is a fellow talks about the way that his rage sort of rolls like the Pontic Sea. And not until he does what he's going to have to do to quell the rage will he feel the satisfaction that he now so desperately craves. But of course, when he does what he does, he immediately knows that it hasn't given him what he needed it to give him. I also talk about a rather extraordinary novel by Trollope called He Knew He Was Right, which is about a jealous husband who also spends the entirety of this doorstop novel trying to find the action that would satisfy the rage that's roiling in him.
Use him as a time specimen, don't you, of what you call righteous anger?
Yeah, exactly. So that phrase, he knew he was right, in a way, the whole chapter is written under the sign of that title. Him knowing he was right is really the way in which we evoke for ourselves or try to play out a fantasy of a kind of godlike anger. What happens with Trevelyan in He Knew He Was Right is that, rather tragically, it all ends up turning on himself. He is literally eaten up by his own anger and becomes emaciated by the force of his own unsatisfied rage.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cautionary tales in this book. You describe, you know, that righteous anger which can't be dissuaded from its course because it can't see another point of view. And you talk about failed anger, I think, which is the if I'm paraphrasing this right, it's the sort of anger that cannot find an object or an object that will satisfy it, yes. and therefore sort of stews. Then you talk about the cynical anger, of which we've touched on this, the, you know, populist politicians, the way that anger is a political resource, be it in a revolutionary age or in the social media age. But if this is a limitless thing, as profoundly wired into us as, you know, the sexual desire, and as impossible to satisfy finally, what can we do with it? What are the solutions you propose, be they societal or individual, to sort of living with it if we can't get rid of it?
Yes, I think that's right. It is a matter of living with and not getting rid. And I think that a lot of literature around anger, and particularly anger management, I think hasn't quite been able to relieve itself of the notion that a sufficient dose of reason, if only we can sort of find a way to get it into ourselves at opportune moments, a sufficient dose of reason will dispel the destructive force of anger. So, of course, the hacks have all become very familiar about counting to 10 and bashing pillows. You know, we've invented these places called rage rooms, in which you can still, I think there's still some hope, and you can put on protective gear, take clubs and sticks to the detritus of everyday life, and then whatever happens to be ailing you that day.
Does that seem to you a good idea? I mean, would beating up a tumble dryer with a baseball bat be a good way of discharging anger?
For about 20 minutes. I think that it provides the relief that, you know, a large scotch gives to an alcoholic. The urge, the itch, is going to regenerate itself pretty quickly. And the risk is that if you indulge in that kind of discharge too often, instead of being an outlet and a release, it becomes in a way the opposite. It becomes a kind of habit that feeds itself, like any addiction. So I think it's a matter of moving away from a notion of conquering or taming our rage and asking ourselves, well, how can we be in contact with our anger in a way that would serve good aims like justice, creativity, even love? And my thought is that we tend to confuse the confusions that go back a very long way within us and in human history, the confusion between anger and aggression, the idea that what anger needs to satisfy itself is an action, is some grand gesture. I think that that is not so much a way of expressing or being in contact with anger as of trying to get rid of it, trying to be in a place where you no longer feel it. And aggressive discharge, of course, has its own place in individual lives and in human history, but it isn't really a way of managing anger. Now, my suggestion is that we, instead of being angry or acting angry, we need perhaps to feel angry. And feeling angry means bearing the burden of it, not talking ourselves out of it. So I'm sort of a bit cautious when people ask me, do you mean reflecting on your anger or analyzing your anger? Sort of yes and no, because people can come into the consulting room and they can talk about their anger. They can say, I was angry at such and such a point, and they can sound insightful and thoughtful and meditative. But what's getting lost, in a way, is the experiential dimension. So the anger is really sort of something that's taking place out there. If they're not in contact with it in the room, then it's just a sort of polite, slightly abstract conversation that we're having. It's when somebody is actually able to bring their anger into the room, to feel comfortable enough in the space to actually talk about why they're angry, including often why they're angry with me. It's then that you have a feeling relationship to anger, as opposed to either a kind of reasoned relationship or a behavioral relationship. In other words, just acting angrily. Now, feeling anger, I think, means being aware of the neighborhood of emotions in which anger resides, because anger often sort of gets marked off from other feelings in a way that can seem artificial. One of the citations that I found really useful in coming to this view is a rather kind of casually disparaging remark that James Baldwin makes about white people's musicality. He says something like, white people think that sad songs are sad and happy songs are happy. And he italicizes the second sad and the second happy, as though to hypostasize them, as though to say that there are these marked off regions of emotional life that we can call sadness and happiness. And his point is that when an emotional life is really alive, it's always inside a continuum of different feelings, that anger is alive because it's next to sadness. It might even be next to joy. It might be next to injury and hurt and frustration and humiliation. When you're able to venture into more fluidly into the relationship between those emotions, I think life starts to feel a bit more three-dimensional. The sort of slightly, hopefully not too glib example that I'll give is the one we all know, which is the road rage example, where I'm making a right turn, someone cuts me up. That someone might be in a nicer car. They might be, say, not entirely arbitrarily, a younger male. Now, I can then do what I've done an infinite number of times, which is start yelling and swearing at them at the top of my voice. The thing is, they've driven past a long time ago. They're not going to be affected by anything I say. And of course, I'm not going to get any real satisfaction from this release of rage. If instead of trying to get rid of the rage I'm feeling immediately to, you know, indulge in that kind of discharge, if instead I try to lean in to the anger I'm feeling, I then immediately am able to say, well, I've just been bested by a younger man in a nicer car. So I'm then in the territory of a certain sadness over the loss of my own youth, the humiliation of, you know, somebody more alpha than me being able to, again, get the better of me. It's a more difficult set of feelings to live with initially, but I think it's also more interesting. I mean, there's something so boring, even to oneself, about sort of regularly blowing up. So I suppose one of the things that psychoanalysis is about, which means that it isn't necessarily for everybody, although I do think that it has something to say to anybody who wants to listen, is that it just gives you a more variegated, more rich and complex feeling life, or at least that's what it aims for.
I want to pick up again, if I may, just before we go, something about this question of the scale and the translation of the individual to the kind of collective, because you've talked about, you know, abstraction in certain levels. And if we start, I guess, from the premise, which you may dispute, that our drives, our basic emotions are kind of tooled for interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
How does it kind of mess with them that they are responding at an individual level to things that are sort of abstract and global in a way that's almost sort of, you know, unthinkable in terms of our kind of adaptive and evolutionary backstory, that we're expected to think about things that are much more than interpersonal and are much more abstract and hard to pin down? I think you used the phrase a hyper object at various points when you're talking about the climate crisis or there's, I mean, is that just an unfortunate evolutionary mismatch? How does it affect the way we express our emotions?
I think it is a sort of traumatic change in human experience that we've had to absorb far more rapidly than we're able to. You know, if we go back a bit more than a century. The sociology, the German sociologist Georg Simmel, was commenting that people living in these new urban conglomerations were seeing more people in a day than their grandparents would see in a lifetime. Now, that basic insight, if you expand it forward into the 21st century, the range of people that we're aware of, the range of phenomena, the range of experiences that are making their way into our sensory and perceptive experience, I think is something that at an evolutionary level, we're not really wired to carry yet. And I'm not sure what the implications of that are, other than they're almost certainly not very good. And I think, you know, for me, the ultimate example, I mean, you mentioned the Hype Project, and the Hype Project really refers to the problem of climate change, or rather the problem of how to respond to it. Because we can, and some people do get angry about global heating and the loss of biodiversity and all the other environmental crises that we face. The difficulty is that the object of our ire and our sense of injustice is so scattered, is so diffuse, that we don't really have an immediate discrete object against which to direct it. And this, of course, gets into the problem of activism. And the problem, which is completely understandable, that people object to the methods of climate activists because they target the wrong victims. You know, they cause birthing women to be held off in traffic or whatever. And so, you know, directing the anger where it needs to go. But if we're burdened by a knowledge that what we're up against is sublimely diffuse, that it's everywhere, how do you expect it to channel itself into one place? I'm not making any case particularly for blocking roads or for causing other kinds of public disruption. I am saying that once you make objections to those tactics, it is quite difficult to imagine what kind of aim and object we could formulate that would effectively address the problem and the offenders.
Josh Cohen, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.